From the 90.5 WESA studios on the historic South Side, this is a live forum on community police relations in Pittsburgh. I'm your host, Paul Guggenheimer. The job of a police officer is perhaps the most dangerous that society has to offer. An all-too-clear reminder of that occurred less than 4 weeks ago when a gunman ambushed two Pennsylvania state troopers, killing one and critically wounding another. In 2009, Pittsburgh police officers Paul Schulo, Eric Kelly, and Stephen Maley were shot to death responding to a domestic disturbance in Staunton Heights. And in 2013, Officer Morgan Jenkins was shot and paralyzed after a traffic stop in Homestead. Over the last two decades, however, tensions between Western Pennsylvania police and African-American residents have grown since the 1995 death of motorist Johnny Gamage after he was pulled over by suburban police in Overbrook. Questions over whether police treat black citizens fairly and whether police administrators supervise and discipline officers properly are at the forefront of tonight's discussion. For the next 90 minutes, our panel and a live studio audience here at the Community Broadcast Center will discuss whether the Pittsburgh police should be held to a higher standard of accountability with a new police chief in place and how to rebuild trust between the police and the community. And now let's meet our panel. Cameron McLay was named the city's new police chief just over a month ago, pending city council approval. He has family connections to the Pittsburgh area and spent time here as a child. He was a longtime Madison, Wisconsin police officer, and before being named police chief, he was a leadership development consultant for the International Association of Chiefs of Police. Brandy Fisher is a community activist in Pittsburgh and strong advocate for police accountability. She is president of the Alliance for Police Accountability. In the wake of the police beating of Jordan Miles, she worked with the U.S. Department of Justice to help create a civil rights division. Sheldon Williams began his 20-year career in public safety as a certified firefighter and paramedic in 1991 before transferring to the Bureau of Police and becoming an officer 6 years later, in addition to his work as a SWAT team member and instructor between 1997 and his retirement in 2011. Mr. Williams served as a senior bomb squad technician, detective, and counterterrorism coordinator. He is now the associate pastor at Allegheny Center Alliance Church. Bill Peduto was sworn in this year as the 60th mayor of Pittsburgh. Prior to that, he worked for 19 years on the Pittsburgh City Council as a staffer and member of council representing District 8. Let's begin with our questions, and we'll start first with a question for Brandy Fisher. The Pittsburgh Police Department has been criticized for having a tumultuous relationship with minorities, especially in the African-American community, and you have been a very vocal critic. Is there a lack of trust of the police among black citizens in Pittsburgh? And if so, why does it exist?
Yes, as a whole, there definitely is a lack of trust. There are various reasons why that exists. But basically, short answer would be because those communities are definitely not treated the same in the city of Pittsburgh. Individuals are stopped and frisked and let go after they're mistreated, even when they're not doing anything because they're walking in certain areas that are deemed to be high crime areas and they have to live there. We've had several cases that have shown and proven people being beaten, brutalized, shot with zero accountability. And when you look at the city of Pittsburgh, you see this occurring at an alarming rate just in certain areas. So the trust comes especially in black communities and also just lower socioeconomic communities in the city of Pittsburgh. They just happen to be predominantly black because they're not treated the same as others in other communities. And when they are mistreated, there's no accountability at all.
Does the community, Brandy, have a responsibility to help the police do its job in a more responsible way, despite that history of misunderstanding? If the police finally get to a point where they get out of their cars and do foot patrols in Homewood and the Hill District and other places, how should the community react, especially if the complexion of the police force isn't changing anytime soon?
I think it's a disservice to call it a misunderstanding, because I don't think it's a misunderstanding. I think when we have these type of acts, they're intentional and intentionally at times covered up. As far as, you know, the community having a responsibility and how they respond, I mean, you have to have, you know, conversations, and there has to be some healing and progress done before you can expect people to open their arms and say, you know, we accept police walking down the street in our community. I think it's a good thing and it's necessary, but there has to be many steps taken before that, before you can find that to be something that is workable within the community. Because if a police officer, if the community still sees the police as being an enemy or above the law or someone that they can't trust when they're in their community, or when a situation happens, they cannot trust their word, then that's not someone you want seeing walking by your door.
Mayor Peduto, you have called naming a police chief after Nate Harper, who resigned prior to being sent to prison after pleading guilty to conspiracy and tax evasion charges, the most important appointment of your term. It has symbolic and literal value that goes beyond the usual appointment. Now you have your chief. Expectations are high. Do you want to ratchet things down a bit now, or are you prepared to elaborate on what you would like to see transpire under Chief McLay's leadership?
Well, I think the hiring of the police chief was a culmination of a lot of other factors. It was really beginning with a change of culture within public safety, and that began before I ever took office. That began when we hired Lourdes Sanchez Ridge to be the city solicitor. Previous solicitors came from corporate background or business backgrounds. Lourdes's background was as a federal prosecutor in Miami in the 1980s going after the drug cartels. She served as a solicitor for the Citizens Police Review Board. It was a statement that we were making early on. We followed that up by hiring Deborah Walker to be the head of OMI and overhauling the Office of Municipal Investigation. The director that had been there for decades. There was a lot of questions over the way the procedures went. Deborah was brought in for her professionalism, for her integrity, and to put into place rules so that people will start to understand how OMI operates. We also overhauled the department. Deborah served as the chair of the Citizens Police Review Board. We then went to look for a public safety director, and for the first time in decades, hired somebody with a background in public safety. Not just a background in public safety, but somebody who was a rank-and-file officer, who was a state trooper, who went to the FBI and worked his way up all the way to the top in heading counterterrorism for the United States. Stephen Bukar returned home to head up public safety to be able to have accountability and a new structure within not just the police bureau, but all of public safety. And then the final part, once we had the capacity built, was to bring in a change agent. For the first time in the city's history, we had a public process in the hiring of a police chief. For the first time in the city's history, we hired from outside the force a new police chief. And we hired somebody who brought with him the ingredients that both the community and the rank and file wanted to see, which was interesting to see that both came along on the same ideals. Somebody who basically was able to communicate both with the community and with the rank and file. Somebody who understands the technology that's out there in order to create a modern force. And somebody who is, to the letter, a believer in community-oriented policing. Whether we ratchet it up now or if we continue at a pace, we have done more than just hiring a police chief. We've created a culture change within Pittsburgh. Now I have the people in place that I feel who know the business, who understand what it means, who have a comprehensive idea about what community policing will be, and that is our goal. Now we have the people to be able to take that, and I can let them begin the process.
And so then, does Chief McLay have a mandate to do whatever it takes to make the Pittsburgh Police a more progressive, effective force for good in the community?
He would not have taken the position, and one of the questions that he asked me during the interview process is, will you allow me to be a police chief? And I gave him not only the rein to be able to make the reforms that are necessary within the Bureau, but also to hire the personnel around him to do so, which means he not only has the ability to create a community-oriented policing system, the ability to bring civilians into his own administration to get to the professional levels that we'll need, but he also has the decisions to say who stays, who goes, who gets promoted, and whatnot without my interference.
Karen McLay, since you were hired just over a month ago, you have said one of your top priorities is to bridge the divide between officers and the community. How will you go about doing that?
The mayor spoke to it really well. On my way in the door, I recognized that there are trust gaps between the police bureau and some of our communities, particularly our communities of color, particularly some of our underprivileged communities. So that I recognized going in. What I didn't know on my way in the door was all of the good things that are actually going on presently. So while I'm finding acceptance from members of the community and the communities of color saying, we're glad you're here, we're glad you want to bring positive change, you want to help move us forward, we want to participate in that dialogue, and that's an exciting opportunity. What I didn't anticipate was the extent to which within the organization I would get a similar response from rank and file. Within the organization, I'm having a lot of people say, we're excited, we're glad you're here, we recognize the need for positive change moving forward. There's a lot of really, really good people, a lot of people who stay with the Pittsburgh Bureau of Police, despite our comparatively low rates of pay compared to adjoining jurisdictions. They're here because they're proud of Pittsburgh. They really want to make a difference. They take great pride in what they do, and they're frustrated at the status quo. And so when I was first introduced to the media and I spoke in my introductory spiel, I shared my analysis, if you will, from a distance of what I thought I was looking at. And what I was recognizing was there was a breakdown in the integrity of the leadership system, that the organization wasn't holding itself accountable for the outcomes of our enforcement work. So we weren't reaching out to the communities and finding out what are the impacts of the kind of police work we're doing on the communities we exist to serve. You know, we exist to reduce crime, fear, and disorder in the communities. And if we're not successful in those outcomes, we're failing. And I interpreted that from afar as a breakdown in the leadership systems. I've shared with some of my top commanders, my assessment was correct. Our responsibility is to look at the way that we police, look at the outcomes we're realizing, and if we're not realizing the outcomes we want, we're not reducing fear, we're not reducing crime and disorder, then we're failing and it's our fault. We own it and we need to fix that. So we have to hold ourselves accountable. Similarly, my commanders, I've discussed with them the importance of ensuring the integrity of our disciplinary processes so that when there's aberrant behavior, our attempts to hold people accountable for those outcomes are effective, meaning we don't find decisions that we made overturned at arbitration. If we choose to fire somebody, they stay fired. If we choose to prosecute them for crimes, we're successful in prosecuting them for crimes. So we do need to improve the integrity of our accountability systems to make sure we're really good at it so that at the end of the day, when there is misconduct, the actions that we take stick. Now, relationships with community is about relationships. So in terms of things that I need to do, I personally and my commanders are going to need to be reaching out and developing relationships with our communities of color. And so I've been challenging my commanders to start coming to the table to me to talk about who they know, who we can talk to, and how we can move those relationships forward. But at the end of the day, and I intend that we are going to follow through with that, and I anticipate at some point we'll be talking about Ferguson-type issues. I talk more about that at that point. But in the interceding period, I recognize that our relationship with our communities of color are never going to be any better than the extent to which we hold ourselves accountable for our performance.
One of the issues that's come up, and I recognizing that you have to tread lightly as you get up to speed on how this police force has done things, sometimes to its detriment for decades, how long do you think it will take before the issue of people living in the city which has become a major concern of having police live within the city limits. Is that something that you support? I know it's not your call, but is it something that you support?
Of the myriad of things on my radar in terms of ensuring, measuring the outcomes of our work performance, measuring the internal, the effectiveness of the internal leadership climate, auditing every one of our processes to find out where they have the integrity, where we're failing. The residency issue is so far, A, be outside of my pay grade, and B, likely to be determined by the courts, that my focus has been on diagnosing what's broken and figure out what we need to do to fix it. So of the many issues we have, I have to confess, I've spent very little time devoting that to the residency. I recognize those decisions will be made, and I will move forward with officers who are committed to the communities they serve, regardless of what, you know, whether they live in or out.
Fair enough. Sheldon Williams, do police need to be trained differently?
I think we look at the standards of training. I think we need to always provide opportunities to be trained often. You say better training, that's always assessed based off of how tactics are deployed and reevaluate them to get the results that we need to get, both with safety for the officers, safety for those who are being arrested, safety for the community. But I mean, when we say better training, sometimes some tactics that are looked at today as being the standard may have to be evaluated later on and say maybe that's not the best tactics. We're seeing some of that with the deployment of tasers. And I will say personally, I've seen what the utilization of tasers had minimized both injuries to suspects and injuries to officers. But the quick decision to move the taser may need to be looked at to say that if we're deploying them too quickly before other ways of de-escalating could possibly be a possibility. So when you're looking at that, I think that's an evaluation. So better, I say training often. And when we talk about the diversity of training, sometimes it comes to a money issue about getting our officer cycle through. There are a certain amount of times people are certified with their firearms and defensive tactics, and they check a box once or twice a year. Could we have better mechanisms to get training and cycle people through training so that we can increase their proficiency? I think that you have to look at that and say, okay, if we're given more opportunities for that, then we can see an increase in our tactics based off of the availability of training that we're making for our officers.
Is every police officer proficient with his or her weapon from what you've observed?
I've been a firearms instructor for many years prior to my retirement, and I'll tell you that there are some officers who come to the range who keep their tactics and keep their firearms proficiency. They come right up there and they deploy their weapons as we expect them. And there are many officers that we have to walk through progressively to get them back to where we need them to be able to acquire the target appropriately. And some of that is familiarization. We encourage officers, we have encouraged officers to take the opportunities to use their own time and to increase their proficiency with firearms. But I'm just saying it is a perishable skill. Handling of the firearm, deployment of the firearm, if they're not doing that frequently and going through drills and doing certain training, it is a perishable skill. And then the split-second decisions to be able to come in and acquire a target, we try our best, or have the police officers try their best to be able to train the officers to be able to acquire their target appropriately whenever those certain threats present themselves. But if an officer only been to the range at a static target, shooting at a paper target once a year, and then has to get into a gunfight, then sometimes there's just those skills are perishable. And so I think more opportunity would show more proficiency with our firearms.
And what do you feel about situations where officers may be outmatched by a muscular young adult who's disrespecting them? What are their options?
Yeah, well, in size itself, you know, I've seen personal experience on the streets where somebody, you know, I shared my personal experience. I had somebody 115 pounds on Butler Street, you know, give me a run for the money. And she was a female. She didn't want to be arrested. And she gave me a run for the money to try to get those cuffs on. So size not necessarily meaning how somebody deploys their tactics to bring somebody under arrest. But I will say that there is a way that an officer assesses that and then they start escalating based on the threat that's presented to them. If somebody's comfortable with being able to manage themselves, no matter what the size of the individual, there's a, you know, there are tactics that we teach in defensive tactics, you know, that gives a competitive advantage when trying to bring people into under arrest or bring them under submission. So, but if you come at it from force on force, if somebody's bigger or stronger than I am, then I'm going to stand personally and teach an officer to stand toe-to-toe with that individual. I'm setting myself up for a loss. So it depends on, and their tactics, using and deploying methods to be able to maximize their efficiency, economy of movement, so that they can bring this person. And then before engaging with the individual, try to de-escalate and get compliance before you have to go hands-on. But when it has to go hands-on, just know that you have to use methods that put them into your advantage versus allowing the other person to take advantage.
You're listening to a live forum on community police relations in Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Our panelists are former police officer Sheldon Williams, who you just heard, Pittsburgh Mayor Bill Peduto, acting police chief Cameron McLay, and Brandy Fisher, president of the Alliance for Police Accountability. We have a live audience, and we're going to take questions from the audience, and we're going to start here in the front row on the left side. Sir, what's your name? Where are you from?
My name is Leon Ford, Sr., I'm the father of Leon Ford Jr. A good way to bridge the gap between the black community and the police officer is by starting with weeding out the bad apples. And you started this program talking about Johnny Gamage. That was, what, over 20 years ago? Well, we have a Leon Ford, and he's not a deceased victim. He's a alive victim. So we still have the police officers on the force that put my son in his wheelchair. And if you want to bridge the gap between the African-American community and the police officer, you have to start by removing the bad apples. And he's a bad apple. And there's a lot of them in that zone. So y'all been hearing it a lot, and I'm sure. So, you know, I'd like to amend Mr. Peduto on the good job he's been doing. And you just came in, and I hope that you do a good job, because for years all we've been hearing is talk, you know. So that's what we want to know, what's going to happen with this officer. I know it's a lot on y'all, but something got to give. Ain't going to be no trust issue in our community if these officers are still on the force. It's not going to be, because right now it's like they're hiding them. I mean, they shouldn't be on the force, period. I mean, if there's a federal investigation going on and he arrests a criminal, then the criminal going to get off later because of his credibility ain't no good. So why are our taxpayers' money, because I work too, our taxpayers' money is paying for these type of officers.
Mr. Ford,
I got to get rid of them first.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your expressing your views here. And just to bring everybody up to speed listening to this who may not be familiar, Leon Ford was shot and paralyzed after fleeing from officers during a traffic stop. Mr. Ford found not guilty of two counts of aggravated assault. A jury deadlocked on all the other charges. So with regard to Mr. Ford's concerns, what are your thoughts? We'll go to Mayor Peduto.
And first off, to the Ford family, you know, I can't imagine what it's like. And I appreciate the fact that you're not only trying to address the issues of your son, but for others as well. I can't speak to the specifics of the case because of the civil trial and also the federal trial, nor to the officer on a direct, but I'll say this, and I hope the chief will back me on this as well. There's three critical areas that within policing that need to be reformed. The first is how we recruit officers, and we're facing charges on that as well about practices in the past which were parts of discrimination. And after that recruitment, as Sheldon was saying, as Reverend was saying, is how we train those officers. And that training is not just something that you do in a camp or an academy. It's a constant part of it. And within the next part is a combination. It's how we promote officers so that they believe within the Bureau itself that it's fair, it's not being done for political purposes, and how we retain them, meaning that not every officer that goes through an academy should be an officer for life. There have been cases that have been fought by the FOP that shouldn't be fought for the goodness of the Bureau itself and making sure that it is one that when every officer puts on that uniform, they feel a certain level of pride. You have to make sure that those officers that aren't meant to be police officers, that we have the ability to make sure that when they aren't to be retained, we can. I can assure you that on all four of those fronts, I'm committed to it. That's why I hired somebody who is also committed to it. That's why I have a public safety director who's looking for that reform. I don't want to get too specific about your specific case, other than to say I think about it often. And there are others as well that will help to guide the judgment that will be happening in the future within the city in the Bureau.
There have been, as long as this has come up now, and I don't know what to what extent.
I could, I'm sure that.
Go ahead, Chief McLay, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, and I concur with the mayor with respect. We can't go too far into the weeds on this particular case because of the pending civil and legal actions. What we can say is, though, it speaks directly to the my earlier point about ensuring the integrity of the accountability systems. Robust accountability systems, thorough investigations, protect the interests both of the citizens of the officer and of the officers. Officers make difficult decisions under stressful circumstances, rapidly evolving situations with a great deal of risk to their own safety, and we have to factor that difficulty in their decision making. So at the end of the day, a good thorough investigation and robust accountability measures protect the officers when they have done the right thing, and they hold the officers accountable when they've made mistakes. And so my intention is to rebuild the integrity of those leadership systems to ensure that the training we provide them gives them the physical skills, like we were just talking about, to perform the tasks of the job, but more importantly, the ability to make those decisions under stress. And taking the acquisition of physical skills and translating it into the ability to perform and make difficult decisions under high levels of stress calls for a lot of training. It calls for very, very high quality training. I spent most of my career in the training realm, and I think training is going to be a key both to improving my leadership systems and accountability systems, but also my officers' decision-making skills. So I'm going to be emphasizing training a great deal so that we test people's abilities not just to hit, as Sheldon was saying, a paper target in a static scene, but rather to make difficult decisions under high levels of stress. Within the Bureau, there are occasions where training has red flagged concerns, and I'm addressing those concerns that got red flagged through training. So the infrastructure exists to use these accountability systems well, and my intention is that we continue to do that to prevent tragedies from happening to the extent that it's humanly possible.
Paul, if I may, I know a lot of people can't speak about the case, but I want to use it as an example of why there is a lot of mistrust and why it continues. I understand that, you know, before guilt or innocence, when you know an officer is under investigation with the use of deadly force, it makes no sense to continue to have the officer in the same zone walking the same streets where the person that is a victim would still come in contact with this officer, or anyone who may be upset by the situation could still come in contact with this officer. Common sense would say to sit the officer down and take the officer off the streets. That's before you decide whether you're firing, which I understand that there's a contract and they have to have, they have mechanisms in place that they have to follow. That's before an officer is charged. It's simple consideration for people in the community to remove the officer from the streets.
Let's before we get to more questions from the audience, and we're going to try to get to as many people as we possibly can during the course of the time that we have, but there's the elephant in the room here, which is that given some of the incidents that have occurred in Western Pennsylvania between police and black residents in the nearly two decades since the death of motorist Johnny Gamage in 1995, is there reason to believe that the actions of some police officers, particularly when it comes to the use of force, are motivated by race? And I'll throw that up to anybody on the panel.
I will say that, going back to you were even talking about residency as a means to ensure that people become part of the thriving community. And I think expecting acculturation to happen just by placement of people in places doesn't necessarily, geographically, is not going to do it. There have to be a mindset that says that they embrace the community and understand that the community they're part of and the community is part of them. And some of the dividing lines that we talk about is in this separatist type of ideas and thoughts, even so much to say in identifying segments of community being exclusive and by themselves. I think we have to come generally and say, you know, we look at community and we're all thriving parts of the community. And so some of the thing about if it's a us versus them mentality, some of the threats and how people perceive threats begin before they leave their doors. And some people bring, and it's not that every officer might be a racist or may, you know, come to their job wanting to discriminate, but just based off of culture and many people are afraid. You talk about the elephant in the room. Some people, how they perceive race themselves as individuals, will sit in one way and then go to their closed doors and feel differently about it when they get behind the closed doors. So we expect police officers to operate at a certain level of integrity and accountability and equity with people in our community when the community itself needs to evaluate and say, how are we embracing people as general, embrace people altogether.
Chief McLay, you wanted to yeah.
No, I want to piggyback off that because I couldn't agree more. There's a significant distinction between conscious bias, you know, in conscious racism, if you will, and what's referred to as implicit or unconscious bias. And it's a well-established scientific fact that all human beings have biases. It's part of the cognitive shortcuts that all human beings make as we try to make sense of the world around us. And so I think I think Sheldon's right. I think the dialogue that needs to start occurring is the fact that race, of course, is an issue. It impacts on how we all perceive one another. And I think that's one of the powerful points of dialogue that we can start having, is having members of community come together with members of law enforcement and start having that conversation. How does it feel to police my neighborhood? And then have the officer be able to share how they're perceived, and then have the community members say, do you know how it feels to us? When you do this, do you know what it does? And for the first time, you start putting out on the table what had been, you know, entirely suppressed. And so from my experience trying to help officers understand issues of race, in my own personal career, the thing that really helped me round the corner and understand this issue well is when I first discovered the research behind implicit bias and the fact that everyone has biases that affect your decision-making and your interaction with other human beings in ways you're not even conscious of. And once you recognize that that's real, that it exists, it makes all of us blameless in this dialogue. And it's a matter of becoming aware of what's implicitly held, those subconscious biases, becoming aware of them. And then when you look at a situation and you recognize race is a variable on the table, having the courage to stop, say, okay, wait a minute, why am I reacting the way I am? Is it based on behavior? Is it concrete? Is it something I can point to? Or do I have a bias that's coloring how I judge this situation? So this is an incredible opportunity if we can make the topic of race something that's safe, where we come together and we talk about what it feels like and how it looks, and we all start tapping into the unconscious biases we have. I think there's an amazing opportunity for awakening on both sides.
Yeah, I'm just going to jump in and say, you know, the first part of breaking any problem is admitting there's a problem. So there is a problem. I mean, it's not something that you can just say, well, it doesn't exist or it's a perception. There's a problem. We got a problem in this town, and we have to address it. We have to be open about it. We have to look at it and say why. And we also have to recognize what the chief said, but also how we ourselves make decisions that make the problem worse. So when our only operation of patrolling is being in a car and driving down the street and looking and watching, you create a wall between the community and the Bureau. It's why we started this year, before the chief even came here, putting the first 13 recruits, who were all suburban officers. They all had experience. That's why they graduated early, into the areas where we needed them the most, and took them out of the cars and had them walk. But not only to have them walk, but to have them walk and to look people in the eye and to say, hello, sir, hello, ma'am. All of a sudden now, there, someone feels respect instead of, what are you doing? That difference, and I know it sounds silly, but that difference makes a world of difference. It's why Director Bukhar said, wear your vests on the inside, not on the outside. So it doesn't look like you're preparing to go into Kosovo. You're planning to go into a neighborhood, and you're wearing a police uniform, not a military uniform. It's why the no baseball caps. But the honored hat that police officers have worn with the checkerboard for 150 years plus in the city of Pittsburgh, and why all of those little things, why we're starting inspections again in every zone so that in the morning the sergeant will come and make sure that your uniform is right, because then you're taking more pride in it. All these little things, the fact that you're able to have officers involved in promoting after school programs and basketball leagues and the things that we walked away from, all these small things, the way that you approach somebody. If I approach you like this and I say, hey, you smile. If I approach you like this, or if I'm wearing wrap glasses and leather gloves that don't have fingers, you feel different towards somebody. You feel, you create that, and it creates an anxiety that we have within us as people instead of giving respect.
And I would say that I think racism is real, and it plays a part in some people's hearts, but I think more so the issue is a prejudice or a prejudging. And when you have an image in your mind that when you go into this community that, you know, and you see a young black male in jeans and a hoodie and you assume he is guilty, or you look at him and criminalize him in your mind, when you address him, you treat him that way. And so I think that's more so the issue than anything, is the prejudging, and then your treatment follows that. And the more that there's a lack of accountability, the worse the behavior gets. And so that's why the escalation is increasing.
Let's take some more questions from our audience. We have a lady on the right side of our audience, and if you could stand up and state your name and where you're from.
Hi, my name is Nicole Faina. I live in Wilkinsburg. Captain McLay, the last place where you were a police officer was Madison, Wisconsin. That city has a population that is 78% white and 7% African American. Now, since this community forum began, it's been mentioned several times that you are community-minded. Can you give us some specific examples, some specific examples of your personal experiences where you have successfully worked with the African American community?
Sure, absolutely. And it gets to the point I was making a little while ago. As a sergeant in the mid-90s, I was a sergeant on a narcotics and gang unit. So I spent time doing street-level drug interdiction. It was at a time when crack cocaine had hit the streets of Madison. We had our first open-air drug markets, much smaller scale than some of the things you see in this city, of course. But the work looks a lot the same. And so during those early periods of time, we would work with informants who would tell us where the drug dealers are, and when we were driven in that way, the only parts of the community we touched and impacted with our policing were those who were engaged in illegal activities. What ended up happening, and it was one of the most frustrating times in my career, was that as the information dried up, we continued to use the tools that the law provides us. We start making traffic stops. Traffic stops become an opportunity to conduct impromptu investigations. And all of a sudden, I felt the community tide working against us. I felt us losing the support of the community we were trying to work. And I didn't understand why. We didn't understand why. And we kept doing what we were doing. I even begged to go do enforcement at the university so I could equal out my demographics. But we said, no, the fear, the crime, the harm is being done in our poor communities, which were predominantly communities of color. So we would go back in doing the same thing, making the same mistake, and having the same results. A short time later, a couple years, I find myself promoted. I'm a lieutenant, and I'm now in charge of the community policing efforts for that same portion of the community. And I find myself leading community conversations where now for the first time in my career, I'm sitting across the table and I'm hearing from members of that community what it feels like to be policed that way. Okay? And all of a sudden I start to realize, oh my God, we were part of the problem. And that was one of those times where I had to realize that we have to be very mindful
that our job is to reduce crime and disorder again and reduce fear. And if what we're doing is not yielding those outcomes, we have to have the relationships within the community to be able to build that bridge, develop the relationships, and learn a more intelligent way of policing that community, a way that we're policing with the consent of those we're serving. And by implementing those more thoughtful strategies, by building those relationships in my community, we assigned neighborhood police officers to some of these areas. One in particular I'm thinking about with this anecdote. And we were successfully able to rebuild that bridge of relationship where now the moral voice of the community helped guide what things we took action on, what things were less of a priority. And when the drug and gang activity exceeded that were happening in that neighborhood were problematic for the people living there, they would help guide us in. And we found a more intelligent way to police. So my experience occurred on a much smaller scale, but human beings are the same. Policing strategies are the same. And when you develop relationships and you get the community members and the police working together, it's amazing what we can accomplish.
You're listening to a live forum on community police relations in Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. Our panelists, one of whom you just heard, Acting Police Chief Cameron McLay, also with us, Pittsburgh Mayor Bill Peduto, former Pittsburgh Police Officer Sheldon Williams, and Brandy Fisher. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and we have a live audience here, and we'll take a question now from someone in our front row. Go ahead, sir.
Hi. I've taught in criminal justice, 30 years full-time and 10 years semi-retired. And so I come with a particular bias, I guess, in terms of having seen people before they go into the police academy and what happens once they get in and get acculturated to that. I'm wondering what your thoughts about attempting to impact the institutions around here where we teach the police officers prior to their getting into that process. This is a place where we could possibly impact them and reshape them before they get reshaped, in a sense. You know, we need to be working on that. It's a small part, but it's important to me, at least.
It's a great question. And
absolutely. And, you know, one of the long-term goals that we have, and something I've spoken to the county executive about, is to create a regional training academy that would be a city-county public safety training academy within the city of Pittsburgh. One of the goals of that would be to begin a program where we begin in high school or even earlier of recruiting people into public safety positions, and then using the Pittsburgh Promise and a partnership with Community College to be able to give them a couple of years to get the necessary credits before doing so. We talk about adding diversity to the police bureau. It would be great if we could actually recruit not just a diverse bureau, but actually Pittsburgh kids into it. It's a long way off. It's a priority, but it is also a way, I think, that could help to instill part of an ongoing training mechanism for the city, beyond the police bureau, but all the public safety bureaus.
If I can say something,
sure,
to
go ahead,
that
Sean.
About, you know, from being, I was assigned to the academy for some time, and that training is the standard, and we make sure that they meet that standard. So leaving the academies, they have the expertise to be able to go on the street and be able to begin to learn the functions of a police officer. But there are attitudes, there are mindsets that exist in the police department that some people start ascribing to that mindset. And so some of that you can't, it can't be controlled unless leadership begins to speak out against that, and when they're seeing that and not at all embrace it or endorse it, but speak out against some of the mindsets that allow some of these individuals to continue to act a certain way and say certain things, you have to speak out against that.
And Sheldon, what is that mindset? Describe that for us.
Well, sometimes, I mean, there is this whole thing about, every day, and I'm going to share personal experience, every day I look at when I leave my family, I have the right to come home to see them the next or at the end of that shift. And that was my priority, is getting through the shift, protecting the citizens, doing my job effectively, but seeing my family at the end of the day. And so some of the situations, you go from a tense, uncertain, rapidly evolving event, you go in and you're chasing a suspect or you're dealing with a situation, and then to move right into something, it takes good coping, de-escalation skills that individual officers have to embrace. And so when officers weren't expressing that, and I see them stress, it takes point-on-point contact that officers should say, hey, you know, let's take a moment, or leadership to do the same. I've seen it done successfully. I've seen when we have allowed officers to continue on and not seeing those warning signs that somebody had brought up. Even so much as the gentleman was talking about when he talked about bad apples, a lot of officers don't come into the police department as a bad apple. Some things develop. But also, too, some of the things that we've experienced here in our own city is that we have not done progressive discipline appropriately. And so when we start seeing certain indicators from first-line supervisors moving on up to start doing it, they're not their buddies, they're their supervisors. So when you see certain things, whether it's retraining issues, whether it's written reprimands, and some of the cases that come back whenever we want to say loss, whenever certain situations where it looks like the officer should have been held accountable, and these arbitration boards then come back and overturn them, is somewhat because there was not a progression of discipline that they could clearly see that says this is how we got to the point. So we got to do better. First line supervisors, decentralization of decision making, allowing not just from a top down, but being able to distribute that. Chief McLay, he has to set the climate and the culture. Everybody has to get into his vision and move forward. And once he sets that, if they deviate from that, they're held accountable. And that's all the way down to the lowest level officer.
Brandy Fisher, I see you nodding as you listen to Sheldon Williams. And this, what he's talking about seems to speak to a lot of the concerns that you expressed earlier.
Definitely. To me, it's always been a simple fix. Which is why I've been so adamant, because I felt like it was just a resistance to change. And so the whole point of doing the work that APA has done was to bring awareness. And so when in the beginning you asked about distrust from the Black community, but since there has been awareness, there is distrust across communities. It's not a Black issue. It's not solely Black people that don't trust this system or this institution or the way that it's ran. It's people who care about people. And so when you have that, as Shelton made it sound so simple, it's as simple as that. If someone's saying, just as our city, everyone knows there's a zero tolerance for crime. We know if you commit a crime, you're going to be arrested and you're going to be prosecuted. We need to have the same message sent to our police force that there is a zero tolerance for misconduct.
And that progression, Paul, the number one complaint against police officers is not use of force. The number one complaint against police officers is discourtesy. And so it's this thing about, and people talking about respect mutually, there's cross lines, but the officers and how they present, whatever, it's disrespect that people feel, whether it's real or it's perceived. But discourtesy is the number one complaint against police officers.
We have a question from the audience. Go ahead.
Hi, my name is Gail Mitchell Hall, and I'm here to just briefly tell you what happened to my son. My mother just passed away. I called the police because my two grown adult children were arguing, and I needed someone to defuse the situation. My husband had just gotten out of the hospital. I called the police because I grew up thinking that police are there to serve and to protect. I called them to my mother's house. They ended up arresting my son. The guy darted into my house, tried to tase my son. I have a document right here that I have signed. I have the report along with all my family members that I'd like for you to see, Chief, because we went downtown and my son was not found guilty, but he's still in jail 4 months later. He's also, when we went there, the police went there with their friends, the judges, with their friends, the prosecutor, and it was quite easy for them to say, because my son was a heroin addict, he's not anymore. He served 11 months in York County prison, and he was out one day. I told the police officer that day that their tensions were flying because my mother had died and my son had just gotten out of jail. That guy did not, and just like you said about size, this police officer was 5 feet, my son was 6'1", and my son challenged him verbally and told him, do not come into my house or I'm gonna sue y'all. They took him out to the car, took 10 minutes to come up with the charge, and said that my son done terroristic threats, that my son said that he was going to shoot y'all. Only one officer ran in the house, and it was the 5-foot guy, and the rest of the police were kind of lost. I don't have anything to say. I came down here to support my son, and I want to support you, Brandy, because I am not the one. I am not the one. I've worked with community advocacy. I'm in strong in administration. I am going to join your team, and we are going to do some stuff. This is ridiculous. I used to trust the police. I do not trust the police anymore.
I'll throw that out to the panel, and maybe Brandy, how representative is this of concerns that come to your attention?
I mean, we get a number of phone calls all of the time about complaints, and the problem is you can't control individuals, but what you can control is your response to their behavior. And so when you have someone and you are and you know, I mean, if she is the one that called the police and you have someone that's coming down to you to explain to you a situation, you have to have a listening ear. And, you know, and just to, you know, we have, this has been an ongoing issue. This is a new administration. These are new leaders who can't be held responsible for what has happened in the past. But we still have things that are present day and that need immediate attention. And so in order to build that trust, and rebuild that trust, we have to move immediately, and we have to take our time to look at each case, and we have to be sincere. It has to be a genuine thing. It can't be that I don't want this case to go any further because I'm afraid to lose money. It has to be because it's unjust. It's not right, and we're not going to stand for it. And so the message that you send is seen and not heard. And so that's what more people need to see. They need to see people acting when they're coming to them with this frustration. There's no reason that this should be at all.
We have a...
Just jump in real quick.
Sure, go ahead, Mayor Peduto.
First off, sitting right next to you is Deborah Walker from the Office of Municipal Investigation and Beth Pittenger from the Citizens Police Review Board.
For Beth, and yep. I know Deborah. I grew up with her.
Make sure
I
that
know
you...
both of them.
Make sure that they have the information. That's number one. And then the second part, too. My uncle was a state trooper for 38 years. He helped to raise me. And after becoming a state trooper, upon resigning, he became the chief of police of Scott Township, where I grew up. And he was, you know, a guy who you could slice a piece of paper on the pleat of his pants. You could see yourself in the shine of his shoe, and he was very, very proud of the way he was. I've been pulled over by state police speeding on the turnpike when I lived in D.C., I wanted to say thank you after they had pulled me over because of the way that they handled it. This is about changing that part of it. I had Sergeant tell me before I ran how he won't write up certain officers because he doesn't want to deal with the politics of writing up those officers, and those officers realized it. When you lose that, you lose the control of any organization. And there's a politics, and even the rank and file will tell you, that has existed that got out of control. We're trying to get that control back. What you saw was what the outcome is when you have that type of loss of control. My goal is to have a police force that people feel they can communicate with to help stop crime, not just go after bad people, but help to stop it. And that at the same time, officers feel that they're being treated fairly within discipline and promotion and retention and all those things I talked about before. We went so far away over the past several years that we lost both. And the same officers that would probably say to you, yeah, that type of thing has happened, or I've seen that happen, but they don't want to say it publicly, would be the same people in the community that would say, you know, the same types of problems. There's a common thread that runs through it with the rank and file and the community, and when you lose that, you lost your bureau. We're going to try and get it back.
Chief McClay, you wanted to chime in.
Yeah, absolutely, and Sheldon said it well in terms of discourtesy being the one of the most common causes, and he also said it well that it starts at the top. It's about the leadership's responsibility to model,
the expectations, and then hold the subordinate leaders within that system accountable for likewise modeling it and then insisting on it, and then at the end of the day holding ourselves accountable for those outcomes. So again, everything, Brandy's right, everything comes back to, at the end of the day, leadership. This isn't terribly complex stuff. We just have to live true to the organization's own core values of accountability, integrity, and respect. We have to hold ourselves accountable, and we have to have the integrity to have our behavior be in aligned with the things that come out of our mouths and the things we put on the wall. And we have to make sure that we insist. I have to make sure that I model, and then I hold people accountable for communicating respect and making it perfectly clear that discourtesy is no longer acceptable. And so, you know, if we're treating people discourteously, those individuals need to be held accountable. Let's not paint all officers with a broad brush, because we have a lot of really good people who do a lot of really good work. We just have to recognize, but I also don't believe in the bad apple theory, because I recognize that an unethical climate will cause aberrant behaviors to occur. So at the end of the day, I'm responsible for the climate within that organization. So it's my role to start modeling and then insisting, creating a climate where it's no longer cool, it's no longer safe or acceptable to treat people poorly. So that's part of my difficult challenge. Culture is a slow thing to change. It takes years and years and years to change culture, but leadership, effective leaders working together, can change a climate a lot faster. And so that's what we're going to be trying to do here.
Let's take another question from the audience, and go ahead and state your name and where you're from.
I'm Mary Hall. I live in the city of Pittsburgh. I really welcome this opportunity for a conversation between the community and the police. I wonder if in the ongoing conversation we could address the issue of a person producing personal identification. At the national level, we've seen videos, unfortunately, of often young African-American men reaching for their identification, and the officer thinks they may be reaching for a weapon. And I wonder if in our discussions we could agree on some sort of procedure for that to happen properly. Thank you.
Well, and that's a great point, and I'll let probably Cameron McLeay respond to that. But this is something that comes up a lot. Someone is reaching for a cell phone, or someone is seen to be carrying a gun that turns out to be a pop can, for example, in the case of Jordan Miles.
He didn't have a pop can.
Allegedly, I beg your pardon. The point being that we're seeing a lot of mistaken identification, and how do we prevent that?
I don't know the statistical frequency with which this error is being made here, so I don't have that kind of background. What I do know is, Sheldon referred to it earlier, again, officers work in a community where it's not simply speculative that an officer might be injured or killed in the line of duty. It's happened recently. It's happened multiple times recently. So in some of the communities, in the community I policed, it was largely speculative in terms of the likelihood that you'd be seriously injured or killed. It didn't happen that often. It's happening here often enough that it's a very real fear of our people going to work. And so officers are trained to react to potential threats to their safety, and they have a very finite window of opportunity to do that, to stop that threat before their own lives are in jeopardy. And so these decisions occur very, very quickly, and that's where training becomes absolutely critical to ensure that our officers use the kind of tactical decision making that keeps them from putting themselves in that situation where they have to react as quickly. So training is absolutely a key. Also key to this is I talked about implicit bias and the role that plays in where and when we perceive threats. And so we have to get our heads around understanding and training our people to have an awareness of when they perceive threat, and have them asking themselves, is the threat real? What am I basing this perception of threat on? We never, ever want to make our officers so tentative that they fail to take action that would save their lives or the lives of someone else. Okay, we need for our officers to make very good decisions, however, under stress, and that's all about training.
I always say that I wouldn't want to be the person running behind someone in a dark alley that I know has a weapon, and because I don't know, you know, I would have to take a lot of training because it takes 2 seconds, if that long, you know, for you to get hit by a bullet. So, you know, when you're thinking, you know, do you want to give a chance for someone to shoot you, you know, in your life, like Shelton said, you know, he's always worried. He was always concerned about making it home back at the end of the day. So I fully understand that. But we also see a pattern that that is something that is constantly stated. And so, and it's not just here in Pittsburgh. I mean, you can look around the country. It's the same message. I thought he had a gun. And so for some officers, they know the language that they need to say to be able to justify certain actions. And so as far as APA is concerned, I think the role is really to educate the community, is to educate the community on how police officers are trained and what certain actions or certain movements, what they're trained to cause to think, and making sure that they know, you know, what is the best time to do this. But when a police officer asks you for your identification and you're reaching for it, that's what you're supposed to do. So I don't want to get misconstrued that at times police officers use that as an excuse to justify excessive force because they know what to say and they know their continuum of force. And so they know exactly what to say. But also other times citizens are not aware that certain movements or sudden movements is or it's going to put an officer on alarm. And those are things that they have to be educated, and that's one thing that the Alliance of Police Accountability plans to do going forward.
Well, I think, too, that, you know, you said officers can't hide safely behind fear for their safety. They have to articulate that and have an articulable reason why they use certain levels of force or come into the decision-making that they do. But some of that, too, is that, you know, when we're talking about reaching or whatever, officers are obligated to do three aspects of control: maintain, regain, or gain control. Maintain, regain, or gain control. And so when they come to a scene and they're assessing that whole thing, they're looking at that and looking at all the totality of the circumstances to make those determinations. What ends up happening in some of those decision-making pathways is that when they start thinking and say certain things look like threats, well, we have established case law that talks about the reasonableness standard of officers, Tennessee v. Garner, Graham v. Connor. These are state Supreme Court decisions that said what officers do reasonably. I'll come back to say that you just can't hide because of what was stated by case law. When you're looking through that and saying what led to that, some of the stuff you talked about with Jordan Miles and this thing about perceived threat, when you see stuff like that, sometimes some officers start moving in those pathways much quicker than they should in some of those decision-making. So it takes a whole aspect of getting more opportunities for them to evaluate that, and that's another training issue.
I should use this opportunity to get to our top of the hour ID, our legal ID. This is WESA Pittsburgh. And you are listening to a live forum on community police relations in Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Our panelists are former Pittsburgh police officer Sheldon Williams, Brandy Fisher, president of the Alliance for Police Accountability, Mayor Bill Peduto, and acting police chief Cameron McLay. We have a live audience. We're going to get to lots of questions. I just wanted to follow up on what you were just talking about. Talk show host Steve Harvey, who is also a parent, recently remarked about the realities of raising African-American adolescents in the wake of incidents like the death of Trayvon Martin, the death of Michael Brown, and for that matter, the police beating of Jordan Miles. He tells his three sons, quote, "When the police stop you, immediately comply. Don't walk away. Don't smart mouth. Get your hands up." End quote. This may be good advice, but is it indicative of a double standard?
Yes. I like to tell people that, you know, the time for you to verbalize where you've been wrong is not on the scene, because every responding officer is only going to take the word of the officer that preceded him, and so him or her. So if you feel like your rights are being violated, the time to do that is not on the scene. It doesn't go well, and it doesn't end well in these situations. So I'm not at all disputing that they're wrong. I'm not qualifying any actions of the officer. To stand up for your rights in that moment, in that time, may not be best advisable, because if it continues to escalate, the responding officers are going to then talk about, and they're going to come respond to the one that preceded them. So what I say is that there is a way, and by law, our state law, that even if it's an unlawful arrest, in this section 500 of our crimes, you cannot lawfully resist an arrest. You can't say that I'm going to resist arrest. You can't, because it's going to keep escalating. So I say at that time, I know how uncomfortable it is for public to hear that. The time for you to verbalize your complaint is not on the scene. Now, the time is through the mechanisms that are established through the CPRB, Citizens Police Review Board, through the Office of Municipal Investigations, and continuing your complaint process through the mechanisms so that it can evaluate that appropriately.
But at the same token, it's very difficult for a citizen who is a human being, when they feel like their life is threatened. Just like a police officer's, sometimes they feel as though their life is threatened, and when they do that, they're able to use deadly force. There seems to be no mechanism for citizens who are fearful of losing their life in that instant. And it wouldn't be about verbally, expressing your concern about the way you're being treated, but more so about saving your life in that instant and in that very moment, which is why we have to be so very adamant and so proactive in our work from this point forward, so we do not find ourselves in those situations.
We have a question from an area behind our overflow audience tonight, our glass enclosed studio we call the Fishbowl. From there is this question, which I will articulate for that audience member. There is tension between African-American teenagers and police. This could cause fights and even death. How do you plan to fix this? And that question was to be directed to you, Cameron McClay.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things we've been spending a lot of time discussing is how do we improve the quality of our relationship with our communities of color generally, but most particularly, how do we improve the quality of our relationships with our young African Americans? If we're going to improve the quality of our recruitment, we have to improve the quality of the relationships. One of the great things about Pittsburgh is that there are so many people at the table within city government and outside of city government who are all at the table willing to work with us to talk about how can we improve our outreach, how do we start developing those relationships. So there are some things that we can do as a police bureau. So we're talking about things like reinstituting the old police athletic leagues. I saw a proposal come through my email this morning where there's a local boxing club wanting to talk about getting a police athletic leagues going there. We have a lot of officers engaged in quiet pockets where they're doing community outreach, developing relationships as well. And what I have to do is identify what some of those best practices are and then find a way to institutionalize them and multiply them out so we get more opportunities. My experience has been that officers have their best opportunities to develop relationships when they develop that human connection one-on-one, and it's those relationships are best formed in the younger years. So we're looking at how can we outreach. We're talking about internship programs at the high school and community college level to start reaching out to a new audience in terms of people with whom to build relationships and then creating a better and broader recruitment pool. So we have to be proactive with this. And again, implicit in our success or failure here will be our success in our own accountability measures to earn more respect from the communities of color. Because at the end of the day, if they don't like us, no one's going to want to join us.
Mayor Peduto.
I just want to really jump in on that very quickly, because it is something that will be a part as we recreate our PERC program in the city and start to look at how community and police relations can improve. But it starts even younger than that. And the chief I shared an email with, we had some concerns on North Euclid Street recently, and asking if some of the patrols in Zone 5 could walk the beat there. And the first thing that happened were the folks that were causing some incidents left. The second thing that happened was the officers that were there took the time to help a girl whose bike had been broken for several months to fix her bike. That's how you do it. You allow officers like Commander Schubert, who created trading cards to give to kids when he sees them, that has the SWAT car and the other cars and the other things, you reward that type of behavior and you say, keep going. You find the officers that are there that understand the importance of community-oriented policing, and you promote them into that role, and you let them become entrepreneurial with it. There's a lot of good cops. There's a lot, the vast majority. You got to find the ones that have that in them. You can't just recruit somebody from within the bureau and say, you're a COP. You find the ones that already have it within their own DNA, and you put them in that position, you build a bureau around them.
Let's take a question from the audience right down, this gentleman here right down in front.
My name is Aniket, and I want to bring it back to the training that was mentioned. There was a lot of talk about their need for more training, better training, frequent training, but the best training in the world is only effective for people who are open to it. So my question is, what's being done to attract and retain the kind of officers and candidates who come into this with a mentality that a police officer's job is to serve and to protect, and to weed out the kinds of people who are doing this because they want to be a cowboy with a gun who gets to lord it over other people?
Thank you.
Chief McLeay, go ahead.
Outstanding question. About a week and a half ago, in the 2 weeks I've been here, we've already had two meetings talking about how we improve our recruitment and our hiring processes. The number one thing I want is I want us recruiting people who share the value systems of police as a service entity. We are peace officers. Our job is to be part of the community and to preserve and maintain and restore peace. And so I'm wanting us to make sure that our hiring process is such that we are screening for values rather than screening out people who may or may not be worthy on various different matrix. What I want to know is, what do you believe? Do you believe what I believe? Show them the organization's mission. Make sure our background checks. Find out what kind of person is this. Do they do community service? And what are they attracted to the job to do? We need a broad diversity of skill sets, talents within the Bureau of Police. There will always be room for those who are attracted to the tactical stuff. They want to be the SWAT cops, firearms instructors. That's all great stuff. But the bulk of what we do is service. And so I want to make sure that we're recruiting, hiring, and training people who walk in the door already with the value system of service. Because at the end of the day, when someone's out there on the street and no one's watching, it's their value system that will determine how they're going to react to the situations around them. So I think that's an excellent point, and that's what we're really going to try to emphasize in our hiring process.
Question from a gentleman in the front row.
Yes, my name is Victor Muhammad. I am the local representative of the Honorable Louis Farrakhan and the Nation of Islam, who have a long history of helping in the black community and trying to break down some of these walls. Mayor Peduto, I got to see you on Chuck Todd's inaugural Meet the Press. You did a very good job. And a lot of politicians seem to have addressed the middle class issues. And the low income and the minority population seem to never be addressed. So with all the economic development going on in the city of Pittsburgh, we keep seeing outsiders come into the city and win these big contracts, and we're not developing the human potential within the city. Also, Chief McLeay, if in fact you're putting these policies in place, how do you plan to stand against the unions that seem to keep getting these police officers back on the force and off? And to both of you, when will you be able to have the moral fortitude, not the legal fortitude, but the moral fortitude to tell the district attorney enough is enough? Because I don't believe racial profiling is just a police thing. The prosecutors are doing it. The judges are doing it. The affidavits of probable cause are so high on blacks. And the sentencing is so high on blacks. When are you going to tell the district attorney to leave Leon alone? We've had enough embarrassment to this city.
Chief McLeay.
There are so many questions in there, and I really wanted to answer that one in the middle. Could you rephrase for me?
Oh, how is it that you're going to address the problems with the unions, the police unions, that keep getting these officers back on because they get reasonable doubt?
we don't get reasonable doubt, like the young lady's son who's sitting right now for 4 months. He didn't get reasonable doubt. He didn't get innocent until proven guilty. He was guilty, so he has to sit until he's proven innocent.
One of the things that really, really excited me when I came here, I wasn't sure how the union was going to react to a change agent chief coming in from the outside talking about positive change. You know what I'm hearing? Thank God you're here. We need leadership. We want change. We want to do better. We want you to help us succeed. I am finding the FOP leadership, I'm finding the rank and file excited about the possibility of living up to the ethics of our profession and our core values. I'm finding them eager to participate in helping to move this forward. Now, at the end of the day, make no mistake, the role of a union is to advocate for their people, and I expect that they will use the tools that are legally available to them to help protect their membership, including from me and the accountability systems. The key to us being effective as a bureau, me being effective as a chief, will be to make sure we're very good at our internal investigations, our criminal investigations, so that at the time we go before an arbitrator, it's similar to when we make a criminal arrest. If we do a good investigation, airtight case, we gather all the relevant evidence, we present it in court, we rarely lose. If we do a sloppy job, we lose. Same thing applies internally. So the way that I make sure that the changes stick is by making sure my processes have integrity. And if we do it right and the officer did nothing wrong, we'll be able to prove it. If we do it right and the officer did something wrong, we'll be able to prove that too.
We have a lady on the left side there who's been waiting an awfully long time to ask her question. So go ahead.
Thank you. My name is Suzanne South. I live here in Pittsburgh. Chief McClay, you told a story a few moments ago about your own experience in your community working within African-American communities and how for years you were really misguided at some point and made a lot of mistakes, and I really appreciated that story. It meant a lot to me to hear that you were humble enough to gain insight and be a learner, because I think that I'm hearing a lot that that's what we're dedicated to in this process of change. Mm-hmm. And from that, I also want to say there are people that didn't take those years to learn that lesson that were in that community and that are in this community that already had those insights. Mm-hmm. And as a person in Pittsburgh, I value so much having the leadership really reflect our town, mm-hmm. and especially the voices that have been left out of leadership. I want to raise up extra space for that, and that specifically is Black women and women of color in our community, mm-hmm. because they already have so much of this insight. And if we're trying to do something new and special here right now in Pittsburgh, this is our blind spot. All this wisdom, all this insight, all this expertise is here. And women of color, especially in these trainings and in these positions you're filling right now, can bring so much of what we have robbed ourselves of. And I hope to hear your response on those. Amen.
Well, it's a good question, and you mentioned earlier, Mayor Peduto, you referred to the lawsuit that's been brought regarding the low numbers of African Americans on the Pittsburgh police force. How should that? How should
on
this
the process
lady's
of how we hire police, which leads then to the final? It's how the recruiting process goes. That is then being questioned by the ACLU of whether or not that in itself is the reason that our numbers are so low.
And the numbers are of 368 officers hired since 2001. 14 were African American. Only 13% of the entire force is Black, compared to 27% of the city's population. So to this lady's concerns,
the historic numbers when they were the lowest was when we had a Black chief. I mean, it's the systematic process that creates those types of numbers, not necessarily.
How should that issue be addressed?
Well, it has been. I mean, one of the other things I forgot to mention is we took OMI out of the police bureau and put it under the law department, so that when these incidents happen, it's not the police investigating the police, but it's the law department that is in charge. And The models of recruiting aren't something we have to invent. There are good policies throughout that. I believe Madison had one of the most diverse police forces that exceeded the numbers, even though it had a low population on minority recruitment. CAMS has the chief has the opportunity now to be able to put together programs like that. I've been talking with my brother, who is a consultant with the U.S. Army. There's going to be a lot of military police who are going to be looking for jobs very soon as we downsize the military. And there's a lot of officers who are African-American down at places like Fort Bragg who would be honored to be police officers in an urban force. And then we have the opportunity to recruit from within and creating a program for training that would work with Pittsburgh Public Schools, Community College, in order to start finding people from right here in Pittsburgh to be a part of it as well.
Cameron McClay.
And I'm also blessed to have some very strong talent within the Bureau. And there's some good diversity among that talent in my Bureau. And so I plan to promote and put in positions to have significant influence those who model the style of policing I want, they model the values I want, and there's good diversity among those that I'm seeing model that. So we're going to certainly do everything we can to improve our recruitment and hiring, and that's going to be a very high priority. I smile because the easier part will be where they fall within the chain of command. So I've got some very talented people right there in front of me, and they're doing a great job right now.
So the proof is in the pudding, right? So the first 6 months of office, we have for the first time ever exceeded the population percentage of African Americans in the city of Pittsburgh on board representation of the important boards, of the big boards, of the URA, the Planning Commission, the PWSA, and Alcosan, and all the others. We have, for the first time, have a higher percentage of people on those boards who are African American than the population of the city, and for the first time in the city's history, have a majority women on the boards. And you know what? We have the most talented boards we've ever created in this city at the same time. It's not trading one for the other. It's simply finding the best people and giving the opportunity. The biggest fact about that, over 90% of the people who are serving on the boards, authorities, and commissions right now in the city for those major boards have never been asked to be on a board, authority, or commission before. We have not only changed the city government, we've changed the makeup of the boards as well.
Let's go to a question from the audience. Go ahead.
Hi, my name is Laura, and I live in Friendship. We've been talking about some very big, pervasive problems that are going to take time to solve. I've been recently harmed by a police action, and this is a much smaller problem. Mm-hmm. It should be a no-brainer and an easy fix, but it's not getting fixed. And here's what happened to me. I had the misfortune to park my car on a Sunday in my neighborhood. I've got a parking permit. I was legally parked. I did not drive my car on Monday. I did not walk past it on Monday. I came out Tuesday, and to my horror, that block was blocked off. Forestry was there, and my car was gone, towed. And I called the Zone 5 Police Department, and they said, "We generally don't like to cause problems for residents in these situations. And we will often run the plates, call you, or knock on the door, give you a chance to move your car." But they didn't do that for me. The fact that
I need to jump in, and I respect and sympathize with your concerns. I think we've got the gist of it. What about the idea that when a break can be given, that it should be given in a case like this?
With respect to your individual case, let's talk offline. Let me see what I can do. In the short term, officers have to take action because of other things it's going on in that block. I have no idea what Public Works or whatever may have had going on, so it'd be irresponsible to even speculate. So just get a hold of me after, and let me see what I can find out.
Very good. We'll try to take another question from the audience, and we have an individual there on the left side. Go ahead.
My name's Lauren. I live in Pittsburgh. So there was a lot of people talking about training opportunities and people feeling safe and comfortable with police. I'd like to know, because nationwide it's something that has happened and people have recorded and posted online, and I'm just wondering how Pittsburgh is going to deal with it if and when well, when it happens. So what are police going to do, or how can they be trained on interacting with people who are disabled or who have mental illness or something like autism that might not be visible? And so that often becomes a problem for youth and adults because it can be seen as like non-compliance or something like that, and it's really scary to think about what's going to happen.
Anybody on the panel want to take that?
I'll take a stab at it. I have not had an opportunity to drill down deep enough to know what the depth of our training looks like with respect to those with disabilities. Like so many of the other issues, though, it does come down to training, and it also comes down to respect and service. So that'll be one of the things. I'm going to be doing a full assessment of our training in across the broad spectrum of our interactions, where we're falling short, and make sure that that's one of the things we look at.
Go ahead, Mayor.
There are a lot of times when you can't recognize a disability. There's also a time when you don't recognize the cultural difference beyond the United States. People from other countries, when pulled over by police, immediately walk out of their car and walk to the police. That is the culture. And immediately our officers are thinking, what's going on? Pittsburgh's changing, and there's a lot of different types of communities now that are going to be a part of it, and that has to be a broader discussion on the whole understanding part.
We're down to just a scant few minutes. Chief McLay, you were hired about the time the tragedy in Ferguson, Missouri occurred, in which Michael Brown, a young black man, was fatally shot by a white police officer. That's come up during this conversation. We can't solve it all tonight, but how did this affect your thinking going into the job?
This is one of the dialogues that needs to happen. I'm familiar with the individuals on both sides of that. I had done training down in that region, and I know that Captain Ron Brown, who was the State Highway Patrol commander, who came in and modeled a respectful way to help facilitate the expression of First Amendment rights and how you lead protests in such a way that allows people the opportunity to express themselves without creating the adversarial nature. In short form, I consider there's a real danger that we could be the next Ferguson. If something bad happens here, we have a flashpoint issue, we could have those same kind of events here. At my command staff meeting last week, I left them with this challenge. Are we in danger? I asked them all, are we in danger of being the next Ferguson? And then I let it sit for a minute. I said, if that were to occur, who do you know in the communities you serve that you could get on the phone and say, how are we going to work through this? How are we going to make this peaceful? How do we keep this from turning into a tragedy? And so we have to develop the lines of communication before there's a crisis, and that's why this dialogue is great. And then at the end of the day, it will be about how we work together to keep it peaceful, and then how we lead the police response in a way that allows people to facilitate their First Amendment rights without coming at it in a force-on-force thing that only causes both sides to escalate.
We're down to a couple minutes, which gives each of you about 30 seconds, and I mean 30, to share your final thoughts.
I'll go first. I just wanted to echo the fact we talked about a lot of distrust in the communities, and I want to be very careful that we're not painting everyone with a broad brush, because there are some police officers like Commander Rochelle Brackney. There are some police officers I spoke to someone about yesterday, Richard McClain, who, you know, have a relationship with the citizens, but what I was told was it's because they lived in the communities and they would get out and play basketball with the people, so the people already knew them. So I think a key point is the residency issue, and I think it's something that we shouldn't sweep under the rug because it's imperative to the community police relations.
Sheldon Williams.
Bridging the gap between community and policing takes opportunities to be engaged like this, to have the tough talks, to understand one another. And so the more that we try to engage in these type of discussions, promote those type of discussions, the only way people are going to learn to change behavior, to understand what behaviors are wrong, and be able to move forward. So continuing to walk together means you got a journey together, and they have to come from the tough aspect of, I'm going to move from my point of being comfortable and move into a place where I need to be engaged so I can learn from this experience and move us forward together.
Mayor Peduto, we'll let you have the last word here.
Well, we have the responsibility right now to see a change happen within the way policing is done within the city of Pittsburgh. And what that means is that we have this opportunity to create a community-oriented policing model, a model that restores the bond between a community and their officers, by putting and decentralizing the power back to the zones, to the sergeants, the lieutenants, and the officers that are a part of the community, and build the bonds with the people. At the same time, we have to restore the morale within the Bureau itself and within the rank and file, and that can only be done if they see the leadership of their Bureau being fair, the same way that the people are looking to be treated fair and equal as well. There's a common thread.
Sorry about that. Thank you, Mayor Peduto. We are out of time. I want to thank our panelists, Acting Police Chief Cameron McLay, Brandy Fisher, President of the Alliance for Police Accountability, former Pittsburgh Police Officer Sheldon Williams, and Pittsburgh Mayor Bill Peduto. Let's give them a big round of applause. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Thank you and good night.